This week on Making Contact.
Hey, Obama! Don't deport my mama! Hey, Obama! Don't deport my mama!
Under President Obama, more than 1 million people have been deported from the United States. We're told many of those people are criminals who've broken more than just immigration law.
The issue that immigrants face is that now there's this increasing collaboration between the criminal justice system and the deportation system. So this means that once you enter the criminal justice system, oftentimes you're on a fast track to deportation out of the country, and usually with no chance of ever coming back to the United States.
On this edition, producer Corey Fisher-Hoffman takes a closer look at how immigration and the criminal justice system work together to detain and deport hundreds of thousands of people every year. I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Have you ever traveled on a Greyhound bus before? Do you know the feeling of standing in the station, looking around to see if your bus will be full, and hoping that after a smooth and uneventful journey, you will safely arrive to your destination? In January of 2010, Alex Alvarez boarded a Greyhound bus in Lawrence, Kansas, and then got off his bus in Orlando to transfer to Immokalee, Florida, but he never arrived to his final destination.
Entrando yo al centro de buses y fui.
I was entering the bus station and I entered calmly, but there was someone who detained me and asked, "Where are you going?" I said, "To Florida, to work." And they asked me for my papers. I didn't present any documentation, and so they immediately handcuffed me and they took me to a room and they said, "Sir, you can't travel because you don't have any papers from here."
Lo siento, ya no puedes viajar porque no tienes papeles de acá.
In this bus station, it was two of us who were detained because we were the only ones who were immigrants. But we didn't commit any crime, absolutely none.
Pero no teníamos ningún delito, absolutamente nada.
Alex Alvarez is from Guatemala. And like so many others, he left his country in search of a way to provide for his family back home. Alex worked in a bakery in Florida for 4 years and then traveled to Kansas. Since he was unable to find reliable work, he decided to return to Florida and see if he could get his old job back. Immigration and Customs Enforcement stopped him, solely based on looking like an immigrant, Alex said. They handcuffed and arrested him, and then took him to an immigrant detention center.
I was in an immigrant detention center. They asked me a lot of questions. What is your name? What is this? What is that? As if I were a criminal, even though I didn't do anything. Then they took me to another detention center where there were more people, and throughout the whole time, we were handcuffed. It enrages me to think about how they treat people. I'm not a criminal, that they should treat me like that, with chains, ties around my wrists, ankles, and waist. It was difficult to go into a room that was completely closed off.
Fue difícil al ir en un cuarto donde absolutamente está cerrado todo, donde
you don't have a right to anything. You go on, they close you off. They keep you there as long as they want, without being able to inform your family. Without being able to just let your family and friends know where you are, you're practically disappeared. They don't give you a right to anything. They didn't give me a telephone just to call my family. Maybe for many, this is not a new experience, but for me, I have never been to a prison or anything like it before, not in my country. I returned to Florida on a bus where one feels like they should be safe, like nothing will happen, but they detain me just for being an immigrant.
Me detuvieron por el hecho de ser inmigrante.
After spending 1 week in a detention center, Alex was deported to Guatemala. Alex was just one of around 350,000 people who were deported from the United States in 2011. Under President Obama, more than 1 million immigrants were deported between 2008 and 2012. Alex had not committed any crime. He had happened to be profiled, which led to his detention and then deportation. Many people listening to Alex's story would be sympathetic, because Alex is not a criminal. The rhetoric around immigration enforcement and deportation has mostly focused on criminals.
It's a significantly larger percentage of criminals who are being deported back, which, I mean, we're all in favor of. Mm-hmm. Your criminals.
Of course.
Illegal immigrant criminals need to be sent back and licensed.
Right. Just to give you the numbers real quick, 48% of the people sent back under Obama were convicted criminals.
That was from a liberal online news program called The Young Turks, but similar commentary can be heard across the United States. What many people don't know is that immigration enforcement does not only affect undocumented immigrants. Many green card holders and legal residents are also at risk for deportation, if they have been convicted of a crime, including a misdemeanor. So who are these criminal immigrants? Here's Abraham Paulos' story.
In 2010, in about October 2010, I was walking home from work, and I was stopped. NYPD arrested me and took me into the precinct, went to central booking, and then ended up at Rikers Island. So I have two priors from 10 years ago involving theft. Considered a misdemeanor in the state that I committed it in, but it's also raises flags in immigration. When I was released out of Rikers Island, out on bail, I was looking for organizations and people to help me with my case. What I had found, though, was that sort of in the realm of my situation, which was a criminal justice situation, and then also an immigration situation, because I'm a stateless refugee, that I found a lot of organizations that worked with criminal justice and a lot of organizations that worked with immigration, but they weren't together. Families for Freedom was one of the first organizations that kind of bridged those two together. So I became a member.
Abraham is now the director for Families for Freedom, which is a New York-based multi-ethnic defense network by and for immigrants facing and fighting deportation. Professor Tanya Golash-Boza is author of the book Immigration Nation: Raids, Detentions, and Deportations in Post-9/11 America. She is a professor of sociology at the University of Kansas, and her research focuses on racial disparities and human rights implications of U.S. immigration policy.
The body that's responsible for immigration policy in the United States is the Department of Homeland Security. They have two enforcement arms. One is called Customs and Border Patrol, and the other one is called Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE.
The following is from an official ICE video designed to educate law enforcement on the Secure Communities program.
A little here about ICE. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a part of DHS, has been around since 2003 and inherited the investigative and enforcement responsibilities of INS. ICE is the second largest investigative agency in the federal government. One of its initiatives is Secure Communities. By 2013, this initiative will be activated in every jurisdiction in the country.
The idea behind Secure Communities is simple. We want to identify for removal those who are in this country unlawfully and committing crimes in our communities at the same time. With Secure Communities, we can now identify deportable aliens who are committing crimes and remove them from the country before they are released.
While ICE Director John Morton makes the program sound very simple, Abraham describes how Secure Communities works from the perspective of being detained.
I get, let's say, arrested, right? And it doesn't matter if I'm guilty or not guilty of the crime that I am arrested for. It's just that I am arrested and apprehended by a local law enforcement. And I get booked into a precinct. And the way that Secure Communities goes is that anyone and everyone that gets booked into a precinct has their fingerprints not only sent to the FBI, which is just has been protocols, and then they also get those fingerprints sent to an immigration database.
Detainers are the key tool that ICE uses to transfer people from the criminal justice system to the deportation system. So basically what it is a request from ICE, once somebody's in the criminal justice system, that the jail or police station hold on to somebody for an additional 48 hours in order to allow ICE to pick that person up.
That was Michelle Fay, co-director of the Immigrant Defense Project, whose mission is to minimize the disproportionate immigration consequences of coming into contact with the criminal justice system. The Immigrant Defense Project and Families for Freedom were part of a campaign to prevent secure communities, or as they call it, SCOM, from being implemented in New York City. Independent of whether a person detained was found guilty of a crime or not, simply having contact with the criminal justice system flags them with immigration. Immigrants, including those with green cards, who have passed criminal convictions, can be placed in deportation hearings, even if they have resided in the country for decades, and they have all U.S. citizen children or grandchildren. For individuals facing criminal charges, they first must complete proceedings for their criminal case and serve their sentence, and then they begin deportation hearings. There have been documentaries and news stories depicting an undocumented mother who gets pulled over for a broken taillight, and the tiny traffic infraction lands her in immigrant detention, only to be deported and separated from her citizen children. ICE claims that these are the unintended consequences of a program designed to capture criminals. And as the earlier news clip suggests, this tough-on-crime rhetoric around immigration becomes the justification for heavy-handed enforcement that affects communities across the United States. We must scratch below the surface to understand where the criminal justice and immigration system meet. One place that they converge is in the fact that both rely on locking people up. On any given day, about 33,000 people are in immigrant detention centers in the United States.
The difference between prison and detention is that you are supposed to be in prison because you've been punished for a crime, right? So most people that are actually in prison are there because they're serving a sentence, right? People who are in immigration detention are not serving any sentence. It's not technically punishment. They're just there because they're waiting for a trial or they're waiting for deportation. But the average time in detention is about 30 days, and many people spend years in there.
It is extremely difficult to fight an immigration case. Lily Salmaron from the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights describes the challenges of legal representation in immigration and deportation proceedings.
A deportation charge is a civil charge. So even though the penalty is exile, which is a huge punishment, our government doesn't see it as something that merits the right to a free lawyer.
Prohibitive costs, frequent transfers between detention facilities, and rigid laws that require mandatory deportation with no discretion are some of the factors that make fighting an immigration case extremely difficult. For many immigrants in the United States, the ICE initiative Secure Communities has converted any interaction with the criminal justice system into a high-risk situation that could lead to deportation.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, and South Africa. A special welcome to station 3CR 855 AM in Melbourne, Australia, which now airs Making Contact. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to The Penalty is Exile, How Immigration and Criminalization Collide, a documentary produced by Corey Fisher Hoffman.
Despite a long history of immigration to the United States, immigration enforcement has a much shorter history.
The history of United States immigration law enforcement is actually not very long. The Border Patrol, for example, only came into existence in 1924 and was only deputized as a police force in 1925.
Here comes the Border Patrol.
Halt!
Border Patrol officers come in contact with lawbreakers of many types. Not only those who are attempting to enter the country illegally, or those trying to smuggle aliens across the borders, but criminals who handle other types of contraband.
When we think about immigration law enforcement, we're really talking about less than 100-year history of really immigration law enforcement in the United States.
I think the history of immigration in the United States is a really complicated one. And I think, well, if you look back, there are so many instances of groups that have been singled out for exclusion from the United States, whether that's them not being able to come into the United States or them being forced to leave the United States. So I think one of the earliest examples is the Chinese Exclusion Act.
When the Border Patrol was created in 1925, actually one of their primary missions was to enforce the Chinese Exclusion Act to make sure that Chinese people, Chinese laborers weren't trying to come across the Mexican border. But in the 1930s, when we had the Great Depression, there began to be more and more pressure from the federal government onto the Border Patrol to enforce the law against Mexicans who wished to come into the country illegally. So in the 1930s, there was a mass repatriation of Mexicans. Estimates vary, but between 500,000 and 1.5 million Mexicans were sent back to Mexico. Mexicans and the children of Mexican citizens, and the U.S.-born children of Mexicans were sent back. During World War II, we interned about 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry and Japanese citizenship. But we didn't call that jail, we just called them internment camps or relocation camps, because they weren't concentration camps, which is what we were criticizing Hitler for having, right? Instead, these were internment camps or relocation camps. In 1954, there was what has been called Operation Wetback. But that was along the border, and the Border Patrol agents officially returned 1 million Mexicans to Mexico. Some of them were living in border towns, and some of them were just coming across the border. So there were those two moments where we sent back lots of Mexicans. Apart from those two historical moments, deportations have averaged about 20,000 per year between 1925 and 1980. Right? So sort of consistently sending back some people, but not very many.
Since the 1980s, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency that we call ICE, has had, for example, presence in a lot of our jails and police stations, sometimes informally and sometimes more formally.
In the past, every generation has had an opportunity to legalize through naturalization. The last mass naturalization took place in 1986. A decade later, the U.S. Congress passed an extremely restrictive immigration policy. In addition to expanding the categories of deportable offenses, the law also mandated enforcement retroactively. This means that people can now be deported for a crime that they committed decades ago, even if that crime was not a deportable offense when they committed it.
In 1996, Congress passed these immigration laws that expanded the categories of convictions that would trigger deportation and also made it much harder for certain classes of people to fight their immigration cases. So you saw this huge spike in deportations after the passage of those laws. So for folks in our community who might have green cards, and most a lot of them do, if any drug conviction triggers deportation, and you know, some people experience this when they travel and then on their way back home can't come back in, even if they've been here for 10 years and have American citizen children.
It's always been pretty easy to return people who come to the border and say that they can't come in, or return people for the Border Patrol to return whoever they want to return from along the border. That's been very common. But what's changed after 1996 is that it's become easier and easier to deport people who live in the United States. So people who come to the attention of immigration authorities now have fewer grounds for appeal, and the grounds on which legally present migrants can be deported has been expanded. But the main thing that's different about today is that legally present migrants can be deported for very minor crimes.
Before 1996, it was 4 crimes, and then after, it's expanded to over 50 crimes. So things like shoplifting, retail theft, drug charges are all considered mandatory detention and deportation. And if you know about 80, a little around 80% of those that are incarcerated are there for nonviolent drug charges. So you can imagine that a lot of the people that are getting deported from this intersection between the criminal justice system and the immigration system are all coming out of sort of this war on drugs, are all coming out of drug penalties.
The issue that immigrants face is that now there's this increasing collaboration between the criminal justice system and the deportation system. So for basically all kinds of immigrants, including green card holders, undocumented immigrants, people with visas, this means that once you enter the criminal justice system, oftentimes you're on a fast track to deportation out of the country, and usually with no chance of ever coming back to the United States.
We don't see this as anything different than what the Japanese went through or Operation Wetback with the Mexicans. We don't really see this being anything different outside of the fact that it's not like we're not being held for political opinions. We're not being held because there's a war against our country. We're just being held because of the fact that we were not born in this country.
So anyone who's not a citizen of the United States can be placed into immigration detention. So what is immigration detention? It's just basically where you await your immigration hearing or you await your deportation. So for example, a detention center could be at the local county jail. A detention center also could be at a place that used to be a prison and has been converted into a detention center. Or a detention center could be a newly built, privately owned facility that's now an immigration detention center.
49% of immigration detention is privatized. The enforcement they asked for, I think this fiscal year, was like $2.5 billion. And like half of that, 49% of that, is going to go to private corporations for a profit, right?
The two corporations with the largest contracts with ICE are the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, and the GEO Group.
What they do with some of these profits is then pay lobbyists to lobby for regressive immigration policies so that their facilities can not only, you know, sort of stay at the status quo, but then also grow.
Wells Fargo invests millions of dollars in the GEO Group, so Families for Freedom organized a picket outside of the bank's Midtown branch. At the protest, Jane explains why she is fighting against the profiting from immigrant detention centers.
Because the government pay a lot of money to detain immigrants, like $166 a day per person. And they only spend like less than a dollar a day for the meals, and they don't offer health care. And so they make a huge profit out of that. And that's why they want as many immigrants to be detained as possible.
Wells Fargo is a major investor in private detention centers. Last year alone, two major companies that run these centers made $3 billion off of detaining immigrants who ought to be their families. Divest Wells Fargo.
That was Ronald, an organizer with Families Fighting for Freedom.
You know, conveniently, detaining immigrants and deporting immigrants around the world has become a lucrative business.
And again, we are talking about a system where there are huge profit motives and where programs like Secure Communities are being fueled by rising detention, and that's really backed by these huge companies that are really profiting off the suffering of our communities. President Obama really does have the ability to stop this program, and to stop the program in its tracks right now. And he can't continue to promise immigrant communities that he is helping them while he's carrying out these anti-immigrant policies through programs like Secure Communities.
Much of the rhetoric around immigration enforcement sounds similar to the excerpt from the ICE video, which uses the language of illegal aliens and criminals. For members of the immigrant community, it is essential to reframe this debate. The most common narrative from the immigrants' rights movement is that immigrants are hard workers, and as long as they don't commit any crime, they should be able to stay in this country. This story can be very compelling, but it divides immigrant communities. Lily Salmeron and Michelle Fay explain their approach to this challenge.
Some of our communities experience really intense policing, and that we can't ignore these kinds of issues. We have to fight for the rights of all immigrants. There's this history of exclusion and this history of the criminal justice system used to oppress communities of color and low-income communities, and that we would be doing our movement a disservice by not linking the two phenomena, by not talking about these things together.
Because I think we've been too comfortable making claims such as, you know, we're not criminals, we're just hardworking immigrants. And I think it's very unfortunate that we're now at a point where we really have to kind of undo a lot of the work that had been done. We've become too comfortable saying that some people do deserve to stay here and some people don't. And I think making those distinctions is not helpful.
And yes, it can be difficult because that sort of framing is so prevalent in the immigrant rights movement narrative, that we deserve to stay because we're good workers. But I think that beyond being good workers, we're also, you know, human beings, and that we would deserve to stay here because of our humanity and not just because we're willing to work, you know, these terrible jobs. When you take that kind of framing all the way to its very end, you know, it's like we're going to accept enforcement, more enforcement in exchange for legalization. But that didn't even happen. We have more enforcement and no legalization. So I think it's time to be a little bit more visionary in terms of what we are looking for and what we're fighting for.
ICE has described 2013 as when it regards ESCOM as being mandatory across the country. We really challenge that. And so a lot of the detainer policies across the country, for example, in Santa Clara and Cook County and New York City has a version of this, really try to limit either ICE's access to immigrants while they're in the criminal justice system or refuse to actually submit to these requests even after ICE makes them. So I think there's really a two-pronged strategy. One is kind of trying to enact local ordinances, local laws that try to limit the number of immigrants that get sent to ICE custody through the criminal justice system. And then the other is really trying to still push for a nationwide termination of secure communities.
The local initiatives are varied, but they are all the result of campaigns targeting local law enforcement to not cooperate with the hold requests issued by ICE. Ending secure communities is an important step to decreasing the massive detentions and deportations. Professor Tanya Golashboza offers an additional step based on the failure of current immigration enforcement policies.
Mass enforcement immigration law is not possible. Attrition through enforcement doesn't work. Right, so then you have to ask, okay, what are the other options? And then I think about it, I say, okay, well, maybe the big problem people seem to have with undocumented migrants is that they don't have papers. Well, the easy solution then is to give them papers.
Alex is still recovering from his deportation, and it is an experience that he says he would not wish upon anyone.
No tengo ningún...
I don't want what happened to me to happen to anyone.
Ojalá que algún día esto pare.
Hopefully one day this will stop. All of this that is happening, I don't know how much longer this will last, but I know that one day all of this will stop, where they won't deport you or detain you simply for being an immigrant.
Estar detenido por el hecho de ser inmigrantes.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to a radio documentary produced by Corey Fisher Hoffman. Special thanks to Alex for sharing his story. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer, producer, Irene Flores, web editor, Lisa Bartfai, Salima Hamirani, and Erin Mathewson, production interns, and Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, and Alton Bird, volunteers. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.